Work that was done in Beltsville, Maryland last year in 2009 with my colleagues. And I'm basically going to summarize the results of two experiments with the response of potato to different levels of phosphorus fertilizer and two levels of carbon dioxide enrichment. Just as a brief overview, the significant research in our laboratory is focused on developing crop models and decision support tools. And so we're really after getting additional sets of quantitative data. And recently, over the next couple of years, we're focused on getting more information on CO2 and nutrient interactions. And as everybody knows, for the most part in this room, I think that most of the published studies with CO2 and different fertilizer, different nutritions, really focus on nitrogen. And there's very little studies that look at phosphorus, and that's one of the things that we're interested in collecting quantitative data with. Even the same with, particularly with potato, although there are one or two published studies with potato looking at different levels of CO2, they aren't varying different levels of phosphorus at the same time. So there really aren't any factorial studies with variations in CO2 and phosphorus. They're not really clearly characterized, particularly for potato. And the literature that's out there for potato is mostly looking at fertilizer requirements in terms of yield trials. And as a result, there's not a whole lot of information either on information on canopy morphology, how lateral leaves and stems are distributed throughout the canopy. And that information is really important in terms of developing models. So one of the things that we're interested in is looking mostly on agronomic perspective, but also some physiological aspects of gaining this quantitative data to improve our modeling tools. And what I'm going to focus on today is mostly on dry matter at harvest, and then some discussion of the canopy morphology, and then a couple notes on the tissue phosphorus and nitrogen concentrations. So this was two experiments, as I mentioned, that were conducted in 2009. These were done at, they were both seven-week studies, and they were, so E1 and E2 are the two studies. They were both conducted in six of our SPAR chambers. These are soil plant atmosphere research chambers. And you can see a picture of this here. Basically, these are semi-closed with respect to the atmosphere. We're pumping in CO2 to maintain the CO2 set point, but they're sealed with respect to environmental control. So we can control temperature, CO2, relative humidity. And they're transparent to sunlight. So one thing we can't control, obviously, is photoperiod or radiation. So the way this was set up in both studies, there were two different CO2 levels at 400, which is about ambient in Beltsville, and 800 part per million. Three of the chambers were maintained at 400, and another three were at 800. And then within each chamber, there were 12 pots. And what we did was to set three different levels of phosphorus using solid amendment, triple superphosphate. And four of these pots were at a low treatment where we didn't add any supplement. There was a minimum amount in the media that we used. We used a medium level, which was 2 grams of solid amendment in E1, and then we dropped it down to 1 gram in E2. And then the high treatment was 8 grams. The pots were 4-gallon pots. This was a sand vermiculite medium. I mentioned the superphosphate. And then the other nutrients, except for potassium, which was also added as a solid amendment, they were combined in a fertigation solution, which was a modified Hoagland's. As I mentioned, what I'm going to talk about today is mostly the morphology and the dry weights and some of the tissue concentration. But one of the notes that I'll be referring back to as we start looking at the results is one of the main differences between these two studies, in addition to having the medium treatment, was that we basically doubled the fertigation in the second study, and that essentially doubled the amount of nitrogen that was available to the plants, and that has pretty big consequences, as you can imagine. So looking at the results now, these are dry weights at harvest at 49 days after emergence for the first study. And this is a ton of data, but just the general trend to get out of this is we're looking at the grams of dry matter per plant on the y-axis, and on the x is the amount of phosphorus fertilizer per pot. And for most organisms except for roots, you have this nonlinear response with phosphorus fertilizer, which is roughly what we'd expect. And in fact, this is looking at now total and tuber mass. So the total mass is the circle points, and the tuber mass is the squares. The open circles are the elevated CO2 response. So again, you have this nonlinear response with phosphorus. The only significant difference comparing treatment means was between the low and medium levels. If you average out across the phosphorus levels, there was a CO2 effect. It increased, the total mass increased, and this was mostly due to an increase in the yield. And in this study, at 49 days after emergence anyway, the harvest index was 44% when you averaged out across the treatments. There was only one interaction, which was for stem dry matter production, and this was only significant at the higher levels of the phosphorus treatment, which is this, it's kind of hard to see from this graph, but this is the circle points up here. The E2 results were pretty much identical, although one thing I want to emphasize, If you look at the maximum dry weight from the first study, it was about 70 grams per plant. If you go back to the second study here, it's about the maxed out at about 110. So we had a lot more dry matter growth, and we'll talk about that. But again, you see the same nonlinear response with phosphorus. In this case, partly because we switched the phosphorus medium treatment from 2 grams to 1 gram, you actually do see significant differences for stem and leaf with respect to the low, medium, and high levels of phosphorus. Again, CO2 is significant when you average across the phosphorus levels, but only for total and tuber mass. And the harvest index was slightly lower in this study. And the same interaction with CO2 and phosphorus was observed, again, just for the stem at the higher levels of phosphorus. So the same exact trends were observed between the two studies. But as I mentioned, you know, a lot of our point in running these experiments is to get data that we can use to develop our models with. And potato, the development of the canopy and the morphology in terms of how leaves and stems are distributed in the canopy is really triggered by lateral branching. And it's really important from a modeling standpoint to get this correct. It's you know, the concern is both how these things are growing, the development of the canopy, and then also the persistence over the course of the season, because really that's triggering leaf area production, which is triggering light interception. So it's really critical to get that correct from a modeling standpoint. And for those who aren't familiar with potato, this is really a gross schematic of it, but you basically have the seed piece or the tuber underneath the ground. You get these little lines are supposed to represent the leaves that are growing. And then at some point, you can get these lateral branches that can emerge pretty much from any axil. The main stem can flower, and you'll get these upper lateral branches. And then these can also flower and get these secondary growths. And in some cultivars and nutritional studies, you can get tertiary and additional orders of branching as well. So it basically can look like a big vine if you give it enough fertilizer. So some of the characteristics that we're interested in is looking at what the average number of branches are per plant in response to these factors. The area that's formed per branch, the number of leaves per branch, the length per branch, all that stuff is important for developing these models. In the literature and some of the results, some of the studies we've done in the past, we know that the branching is highly dependent on cultivar. It's also influenced by nitrogen nutrition, and we suspect it's a carbon to nitrogen ratio within the plant. And then also some environmental factors seem to encourage it as well. The effects of CO2 and phosphorus aren't as well known, and Jeff, you mentioned sort of indirectly whether CO2 had an effect on some of the phenology. And it's very slight in potato from the studies we've done. And there's only little evidence that actually affects lateral branching from previous studies we've looked at. But it may have an indirect effect in terms of the carbon-nitrogen ratio. Also, phosphorus effects in literature are really not well documented. So that's something we're interested in studying. So what I did here is try to throw up a bunch of data and confuse everybody. But actually, all this is just summarizing those four points. So you have here's the branches per plant, the average length per branch, the average area per branch, and then the number of leaves per branch on an average basis. The blue here is the second experiment, and the reds are the first experiment. And again, the open symbols are the elevated CO2 response. The take-home message from this is, again, you have the same trends that we saw with dry matter production with respect to phosphorus, that these nonlinear trends. And in the second study, there actually were separations between low, medium, and high levels of phosphorus. The CO2 effect was only significant in E1 in terms of the number of branches that form per plant and at the amount of area that formed per branch. These washed out with E2 that weren't actually significant. When you scale this information up to a whole plant basis, the trends are kind of what you'd expect. And what I'm showing here is looking at stem dry matter production broken down according to the total plant, to the main stem, and then just to the lateral branching growth. But if I plotted instead the dry matter for leaf production or leaf area, you'd see almost the same exact trend. So I just show the stem dry matter for sake of time here. And this is the E1 study. This is E2. So again, you have grams per plant in the y-axis. And then this is the ambient CO2 and elevated CO2 groupings with low, medium, and high levels of phosphorus. So you can see you kind of have the lighter colors here are the lateral branch production or lateral stem branch production. You have these nice little stepladder effects in E1. And in E2, it's even more pronounced. This color should be shaded. But you can see it's even more pronounced stepladder effect, which is what we'd expect from the previous trends that we saw. So again, phosphorus was significant for both studies. With E2, though, you had significant differences between low, medium, and high levels of phosphorus. The CO2 effect was significant in both studies for lateral stem branch production when you pull it over the whole plant. So in other words, if I just took these lighter shades and averaged them out across the different CO2 levels, in both studies, there was a slight increase in that lateral branch production with response to CO2, just for lateral branch. There were no interactions that were significant. And again, another thing to look at is the difference between the two studies. There was about 3 times as much biomass as far as the stem production, lateral stem production in E2 versus E1. A couple notes on the tissue concentrations. This is looking at phosphorus. Because in this case, all the organs above ground had very similar CO2 and phosphorus responses in both studies, as well as the below ground organs. What I did is to average them out. So leaf, stem, above ground, I averaged it out for each study, and there was no CO2 effect, which means that CO2 did not reduce the phosphorus content in the tissue, in either above ground or below ground tissues. So the data we're looking at here is, this is E1 averaged out across all organs for both CO2 levels, and then same thing for E2, and then this is the below ground results with the same study. But phosphorus, clearly it was significant that you had a linear response with the tissue concentration for phosphorus. One thing that I thought was kind of nice to see is in the field studies, that shows that about 0.2% in the vegetative tissue, below that you get a stress response in terms of not getting your maximal yield. And that falls right about here, which is below the, right below the medium phosphorus response in the E1 study. And if you recall, there's no difference between medium high in that study, but in E2, where we switched the phosphorus medium treatment to 1 gram, this would actually be considered the stress case. And if you remember, there was a difference between medium and high. So it's kind of nice to see this actually did follow the field studies, even though this was done in a growth chamber. Nitrogen concentrations were, I guess, politely speaking, it was kind of a mess, that we actually did see differences in CO2 and phosphorus response for every organ. And there were differences between the two studies. But for the sake of time, and roughly the same trends were observed, just to let the magnitudes were off. But for the sake of time, what I did here, again, too, is average this according to the vegetative above ground and versus below ground. And one of the surprising results that we had is CO2 did not significantly reduce nitrogen content in tissues, either below or above ground. Now, the nitrogen contents were smaller, but we actually didn't see a significant effect, so that was pretty surprising. As before, there was no CO2 and phosphorus interaction, but the phosphorus itself was significant, but it wasn't consistent between different experiments. In E1, this drop-off from the low to the medium and high was a significant reduction in N content and vegetative growth. In E2, this was not significant, so there was a bit of inconsistency there. But a lot of this dealt with the fact that we basically doubled the nitrogen availability in the second study. And if you look at the nitrogen contents in the vegetative tissue, these are about almost twice as high. Again, in the literature, looking at mid-season threshold values for nitrogen content in potato tissue, about 5.8 for leaf and 4.5% for stem nitrogen is the sort of minimum threshold below which you don't get 90% of your yield. And that's pretty much the case with E1 throughout the whole experiment. And that would partially explain why we got so much less biomass production in that study. Okay, so wrapping some of this up, there's a lot of different angles to talk about, and I'll just do this briefly, and we can talk more about it later. There's a lack of CO2 and phosphorus interactions for almost every response. And what that means effectively is that the CO2 enrichment response, at least for this potato cultivar, the conditions we studied, was independent of phosphorus fertilization. And in a sense, that actually makes life a little bit easier for the modeling. The increase in yield with CO2 was consistent with what we've observed in the literature. There is some discrepancy with potato responses that some studies have shown that the canopy dry matter increases as well. We didn't see that in this study. And some other studies I've run have shown both things happening. So there's obviously another factor we need to consider. Phosphorus deficiency effects, these were consistent with the field where you had reduced canopy production and yield reductions. As we noted, the tissue phosphorus contents were consistent in literature. This little blurb here is just the fact that if you scale up the phosphorus contents in the pots to a field basis, they actually were equivalent to essentially the average amount that all these studies would recommend to get 90% of your maximum yield in the field. And so again, our studies in the growth chamber actually nicely followed what was happening in the field, which I was surprised but happy to see that. And again, there's a strong effect on lateral branch development, and I'll continue that thought in a second. So looking between the two experiments, again, the fertilization was doubled in E2, and this was really reflected in the tissue nitrogen concentrations. And as a result, you really triggered a lot more lateral branch production in that second study, which is why you had much greater canopy development, much more leaf area, and as a result, more biomass. But if you recall, that lowest level of phosphorus in E2 still had really little lateral growth. So even though that plant had lots of nitrogen, it still can produce a lateral branches, and this is indicative that there's probably a phosphorus or nitrogen ratio that's involved in triggering some of the branching of potato. And there's one other study that Jenkins and Mahmood had done in a greenhouse with a different variety, and they had some similar results that suggest that there is definitely a link with that. So that's an important modeling consideration. I'm just going to skip over this because I'm almost out of time. But essentially, the effect of phosphorus fertilizer and CO2 and the tissue concentration of nitrogen was surprising. As I mentioned, there really wasn't a significant CO2 effect. Phosphorus really didn't affect nitrogen content significantly. It wasn't consistent, and there's some thoughts on that. The effect of these two treatments on the phosphorus tissue content, CO2 didn't have an effect. Tissue content clearly linearly increased with our phosphorus fertilizer. In the literature, it's really mixed as whether or not CO2 affects phosphorus content. As I mentioned earlier, there's no factorial studies with potato to compare this with, but there were studies with cotton and wheat, and they actually had pretty similar results where CO2 did not affect the phosphorus tissue concentration. And their suggestion was that more phosphorus is simply needed because you had more growth with the elevated CO2, and that's basically what we would have observed in our study. So summary, the effect of phosphorus deficiency may be associated with the plant nitrogen status, at least as far as lateral branch development. The phosphorus nutrient status and the canopy growth was really barely influenced by CO2. And what this means as far as a fertilizer recommendation, at least for the fixed temperature that we looked at, that phosphorus fertilizer requirements are probably not affected by the CO2 aspect of climate change, at least considering this on a unit mass basis. And with that, I'll just thank our technicians and the Toledo group for helping us with the phosphorus analysis and take any questions.
Surprised you the most about your
results? I think the lack of nitrogen, the lack of CO2 effect on reducing nitrogen contents. Because we've done previous studies where that's been significant. And to be honest, I'm not entirely sure what happened with this study, although I did read there's a summary of some of the CO2 effects on C3 plants in Gifford et al., I think it's 2002, that they had some results where if you have really luxury nitrogen fertilizer, and you see that with the E2 study, that you actually can get a case where the leaves actually take more. They actually found with elevated CO2, some of the plants actually uptook more, or the nitrogen content was greater in those leaves. And that would have explained the response in E2, but maybe not in E1, why there was no CO2 effect on nitrogen content. Oscar.
Did you use the same rooting or watering system in both studies?
Yeah, the only difference, so everything was the same except that we basically doubled the fertigation.
Previous nitrogen.
Oh, the other studies. No, it was a different fertilizer. That study was 100% fertigation, so there was no solid amendment in that study. Yeah, so that might be a consideration also.
With your system, were those two studies consecutive in time?
Yes, yeah.
So do you suppose that light environment, which is partly what you did not control,
It could have, and actually, I can't recall the exact numbers now, but this results were, they've been accepted in the Journal of Plant Nutrition. But the photoperiods were almost identical, but the second study, the PAR was, I think, on the average, about 2 to 3 moles per meter squared per day higher in the second study. So that actually, obviously, that's another effect as well. Yeah, unfortunately, that's probably one of the few one of the challenges with doing the spar chamber research is you can't replicate in time. Yeah. Okay, open questions for me, too, but any of the other speakers this afternoon also. Everybody's free game. Sure.
Yeah, for any study on phosphorus effect, very often plant nitrogen status is also changed automatically. Mm-hmm. So people very often get confused when the end result is the effect of phosphorus or the effect of nitrogen.
Yeah.
So my question to you is that at the beginning, in your introduction, you said most studies studied the CO2 and the nitrogen interaction, but not the CO2 with the phosphorus. But your study has the same problem with the previous study about the phosphorus.
Well,
That's
true, except what I mean by that is if you look, most of the studies, they'll look at different levels of CO2, but if they're done in a field study or even in some of the greenhouse studies, they use the same phosphorus level. So they'll usually vary CO2 and nitrogen. So you might have different levels of nitrogen or different levels of nitrogen fertilizer and different levels of CO2, but they'll report phosphorus as an additional response. But phosphorus itself isn't specifically varied as a treatment. So in this case, if you look, you know, keeping each experiment individually, each experiment does have a factorial design where you've got two levels of phosphorus and three levels of phosphorus and two levels of CO2. But yeah, the problem is if you combine the two experiments together, you really can't do that because some of the conditions have changed. So I'm not sure if that answers your question. But.
Going back to the CO2 and nitrogen content. Generally speaking, if you have adequate nitrogen fertilization, either the greenhouse conditions or the field, and you kill you don't have more nitrate or nitrogen content unless you put or you expose the plants into a higher light intensity. And that's what's being established in the literature. So therefore, maybe increasing the CO2 is no further response of nitrogen uptake and assimilation, because the assimilation depends more on the light intensity. And what happens is, especially potatoes, it stores the nitrogen in form of nitrate, it can be stored in the body.
Mm-hmm.
So the light is getting just there. Light makes that nitrate in the vacuum available inside the plasma. So that's generally what the literature says. The other thing about phosphorus, generally speaking, its uptake depends on diffusion. It's more moisture dependent or drought wet conditions. So this is maybe what's happening, at least based on the literature.
Yeah.
The other question I have, if I may, over here, if you have something
else, go ahead. No, I was just going to I just lost my train of thought. Go ahead with your second question. It'll probably come back to me.
Second question for the grain protein.
Yes.
You found some response, I think, lower content. Maybe this may, let's put it this way. If you have amino acid profile, you can look at amino acid quality of the grain itself, may give you some further knowledge about the effect of elevated CO2 on the quality of the amino acid.
It
could be something going on there.
It's a big project. It's hard to talk about it all in your 13 minutes of fame you get standing up there, but. What we have is looking ahead from here into the future. Of course, we have our archived grain samples. What we've done is besides